Testing seems an inadequate term for you, brother. This is for you. He gestured to a nearby workbench, where a block of marble rested, a chisel sitting atop it. The block was a perfect cube of white marble, the same block from his vision when Arm Lin Song had laid him low, its surface smooth under Valen's fingers.
"You obtained this for me?" he asked.
"Many years ago. My song was most emphatic. Whatever rests inside has been waiting a long time for you to set it free."
"Waiting?"
Venin flattened his palm against the stone, feeling a surge from the blood song. The tune a mix of warning and certainty. The one who waits. He lifted the chisel, touching the blade tentatively to the stone.
"I've never done this," he told Arm Lin. "Can't even carve a decent walking stick."
"Your song will guide your hands, as mine guides me. These statues are as much the work of my song as my skill." He was right. The song was building, strong and clear, guiding the chisel over the stone. Venin hefted a mallet from the bench and tapped the butt of the chisel, chipping a small piece of marble from the edge of the cube. The song surged, and his hands moved. Arm Lin in the workshop, fading as the work consumed him. There were no thoughts in his head, no distractions. There was just the song and the stone. He had no sense of time, no perception of the world beyond the song, and it was only a rough shake to the shoulder that brought him back.
"Valen!"
Barker shook him again when he didn't respond.
"What are you doing?"
Valen looked at the tools in his dust-caked hands, noting his cloak and weapons lying nearby, and having no memory of removing them. The stone was radically altered, the top half now a roughly hewn dome, with two shallow indentations in the center, and the ghost of a chin forming at the base.
"Standing here hammering away with no weapons and no guard?"
Barker sounded more shocked than angry.
"Any passing Alperian could have stuck you without breaking a sweat."
"I..." Benin blinked at him in confusion.
"I was..."
He trailed off, realizing any explanation was pointless. Arm Lin and the woman who had answered the door were standing nearby, the woman glaring at the two soldiers Barkus had brought with him. Arm Lin was more relaxed, idly guiding a whetstone over the tip of one of his chisels, favoring Valen with a slight smile of what might have been admiration. Barkus's gaze shifted to the stone, then back to Valen, a frown creasing his heavy brows.
"What's that supposed to be?"
"Doesn't matter." Valen reached for a piece of linen and draped it over the stone.
"What do you want, brother?"
He was unable to keep the irritation from his tone.
"Sister Gilmer needs you, at the governor's mansion."
Venin shook his head impatiently, reaching again for his tools.
"Canis deals with the governor. Send him. He has been sent for. She needs you as well." "I'm sure it can wait."
Barkus's hand was tight on his wrist, pulling his lips close to Valen's ear and whispering two words, which made him drop his tools and reach for his cloak and weapons without further demur, despite the immediate howl of protest from the bloodsong. The Red Hand. Sister Gilmer stood on the other side of the mansion gate, having forbidden them from coming any closer. For once there was no trace of mirth in her tone or bearing. Her face was pale, her usually bright eyes dimmed with fear. "Just the governor's daughter for now, but there'll be others."
"You're certain?"
Venin asked her. "Every member of my order is taught to look for the signs from the moment we join." "There's no doubt, brother."
"You examined the girl. You touched her."
Gilmer nodded wordlessly. Venin fought down the sorrow clutching at his chest.
"No time for weakness now. What do you need?"
"The mansion must be sealed and guarded. No one can be allowed in or out. You must be watchful for any more victims in the city at large. My orderlies know what to look for. Any found to have the sickness must be brought here, by force if necessary. Masks and gloves must be worn when dealing with them. You must also seal the city. No ships can sail, no caravans can leave."
"There'll be panic,"
Canis warned. "The Red Hand killed as many Alperians as realm folk in its time. When word spreads, they'll be desperate to flee."
"Then you'll have to stop them," Sister Gilmer said flatly.
"We cannot allow this plague loose again." She fixed her gaze on Valen.
"You understand, brother?" You must do whatever is required.
I understand, sister. Through his sorrow, a dim memory began to surface. Sharon at the High Keep. He tended to avoid thinking of that time. The sense of loss was too great. But now he fought to recall her words that morning after the death of Henter's muster. The usurper's followers had trapped her with a false report of an outbreak of the Red Hand in Warrensclave. I had been working on a cure.
Sister Sharon, he said. She told me once that she had a cure for the sickness.
A possible cure, brother, Gilmore replied, based on theory only, and beyond my skills to formulate in any case.
Where is Sister Sharon stationed these days?
Phelan persisted.
At the Order House, last I heard.
She is mistress of curatives now.
20 days sailing with a good wind, Canis said, and 20 days back.
For an Alpiran or realm vessel,
Phelan mused softly.
He turned back to Gilmer.
Sister, ask the governor to write a proclamation confirming your measures, and ordering the city folk to cooperate. Brother Canis will have it copied and distributed about the city.
He turned to Canis.
Brother, see to the guarding of the gates and the mansion. Double the guard on the walls. Use our men only where possible.
He glanced back at Sister Gilmer and forced an encouraging smile.
What is hope, sister?
Hope is the heart of the faith. Abandonment of hope is a denial of the faith.
Her own smile was faint.
I have certain instruments and curatives in my quarters. I should like them brought to me.
I'll see to it, Canis assured her.
Velen turned to go, hurrying along the stone-paved path.
What about the docks? Canis called after him.
Velen didn't look back.
I'll see to the docks.
The Meldinan captain was compact and wiry, sitting across the table from Velen, with his lean features drawn in a suspicious glare. He wore gloves of soft leather, his hands clasped in a double fist on the table. They were in the map room of the old Merchant's Guild building, a lone, safe apprentice, who guarded the door. Outside, night was drawing on quickly, and the city would soon be sleeping, still blissfully unaware of the crisis that would greet them in the morning. If the captain had any complaints about how he and his crew had been hauled from their bunks, forced to strip and submit to inspection by Sister Gilmer's orderlies before being brought here, he clearly felt it best to keep them to himself.
You are Carvel Nurin? Velen asked him.
Captain of the Red Falcon.
The man gave a slow nod. His eyes flickered continually between Velen and Frentis, occasionally lingering on their swords.
Velen felt no desire to alleviate the man's unease. It suited his purpose to keep him scared.
Your ship is reputed to be the fastest vessel to sail from this port, Velen went on.
Finest lines of any hull crafted in the Meldinian yard, so they say.
Carvel Nurin inclined his head, but remained silent.
You have no reputation for piracy or dishonesty. Unusual for a captain from your islands.
What do you want?
The man's voice was harsh, rasping, and Velen noticed the pale edge of a scar protruding from the black silk scarf he wore around his throat. Pirate or not, he had seen his share of trouble on the seas.
To engage your services, Velen replied mildly.
How fast can you get to Varenshold? The captain's unease lessened, but suspicion still clouded his face.
Done it in 15 days before. Udenor was kind with the northerlies.
Udenor, Velen knew, was one of the Meldinian gods said to have dominion over the winds.
Can it be done quicker?
Nurin shrugged.
Maybe. With an empty hold and a few more hands to run the rigging.
And 2 goats for Udenor, of course.
It was common practice for Meldinians to sacrifice animals to their favored gods before a hazardous voyage.
Velen had been witness to a mass slaughter of livestock before their invasion fleet left port. The blood had flowed so freely, the harbor waters turned red.
We'll provide the goats, he said, and gestured for Frentis to come forward.
Brother Frentis and 2 of my men will be your passengers. You will carry him to Varenshold, where he will collect another passenger. You will then return here. The whole voyage cannot take more than 25 days.
Is it possible?
Nurin considered for a moment and nodded.
Possible, yes. But not for my ship.
Why not?
Nurin unclasped his hands and slowly removed his gloves, revealing mottled and discoloured skin from fingers to wrist. "Tell me, landbound," he said, holding his hands up for Valen's inspection. The lamplight gleamed on the waxy, misshapen flesh. "Have you ever beaten at flames with your bare hands whilst your sister and mother burned to death?" A grim smile twisted the Meldinian's lips. "No, my ship will not sail in your service. The Alperans call you the Hope Killer. To me, you are the spawn of the City Burner. The shiplords may abhor themselves to your king, but I will not. Whatever threats or torments you employ will make no—" The bluestone made a soft thud as Venin placed it on the table, spinning it around, lamplight flickering on the silver-veined surface. Carvel Nurin stared at it in astonished and unbridled greed. "I'm sorry about your mother and your sister," Valen said. "And your hands. It must have been very painful." He continued to spin the bluestone. Nurin's eyes never left it. "But I sense you are, above all, a man of business, and sentiment is hardly profitable." Nurin swallowed, his scarred hands twitching. "How much do I get? If you return within 25 days, all of it." "You lie." "On occasion, but not right now." Nurin's eyes finally shifted from the bluestone, meeting Valen's. "What surety do I have?" "My word, as a brother of the Sixth Order." "Pox take your word and your order. Your ghost-worshipping nonsense means nothing to me." Nurin pulled his gloves on, frowning in calculation. "I want a side assurance, witnessed by the governor. The governor is indisposed, but I'm sure the Grand Master of the Merchant's Guild will be happy to oblige. Good enough?" The Red Falcon differed markedly from any other ship Valen had seen. She was smaller than most, with a narrow hull and 3 masts instead of the usual 2. There were only 2 decks, and she carried a crew of just 20 men. "Built for the tea trade," Carvel Nurin explained gruffly when Valen remarked on the unusual design. "Fresher it is, the more profit you make. Small cargo of fresh tea makes 3 times the price of the stuff shipped in bulk. Quicker you get it from one port to another, the more money you make." "No oars?" Prentiss asked. "Thought all Meldinian ships had oars." "Got 'em right enough." Nurin pointed at the sealed ports on the lower deck. "Only use 'em when the wind dies, which it rarely does in northern waters. In any case, the Falcon will shift with even the smallest breeze." The captain paused to cast his gaze around the docks, taking in the rows of silent and empty ships, and the cordon of wolf runners guarding the quayside. The crews had been ordered from their vessels during the night, not without some trouble, and were now nursing their bruises under heavy guard in the warehouses nearby. "Can't remember the Linesh docks ever being so quiet," Nurin observed. "War is bad for trade, Captain," Valen replied. "Ships came and went at their leave over the past month, and now they sit empty with their crews imprisoned. And yet the Falcon alone is permitted to sail. We can't be too careful." Valen clapped him on the back affably, provoking a shudder of fearful repugnance. "Plenty of spies about. When do you sail, Captain?" "Another hour, when the tide's right." "Then don't allow me to delay your preparations." Nurin suppressed a sneering response and nodded, walking up the gangplank to assail his crew with a barrage of curse-filled orders. "Do you think he knows?" Prentiss asked. "He suspects something, but he doesn't know." He gave Prentiss an apologetic smile. "I'd send more men with you, but it might arouse even more suspicion. Sister Gilmer's orderlies told you what to look for." Prentiss nodded. "Swelling in the neck, sweats, dizziness, and rashes on the arms. If any of them have it, they'll start showing within 3 days. "Good. You understand, brother, that if any of the crew, including yourself, show signs of the Red Hand, this ship cannot land in Varishold, or anywhere else." Prentiss nodded. Valen could detect no fear or reluctance in him. The Bloodsong spoke of only a basic and unshakable trust, an almost unreasoning loyalty. The thin, ragged boy who had pleaded for his support all those years ago in the Aspect's room was gone now, forged into a seasoned and fearfully skilled warrior who would never question his orders. There were times when having command of Frentis felt more like a burden than a blessing. He was a weapon to be used only with great care, for there was no sheathing him once unleashed. "I regret the necessity of this, brother," he said. "If there were any other course..."
"You never gave me that lesson," Frentis said.
Valen frowned.
"Lesson?"
"The throwing knife. You said you'd teach me. Thought I'd learned enough myself. Was wrong about that. You've been taught much since."
Valen felt a sudden surge of guilt. All the battles fought by this blindly trusting young man, the wounds suffered, all the lives he had taken.
"You wanted to be a brother," he said, failing to keep the guilt from his voice. "Did we do right by you?" To his surprise, Frentis laughed.
"Do right by me? When did you ever do wrong?"
"When I scarred you. The tests hurt you. You followed me here to war and pain. What else was there for me? Hunger and fear, and a knife in an alley to leave me bleeding in a gutter?"
Frentis gripped his shoulder. "Now I have brothers who would die in my defense, as I would die for them. Now I have a faith."
His smile was fierce, unwavering, complete in its conviction. "What is faith, brother?"
"The faith is all. The faith consumes us and frees us. The faith shapes my life, in this world and in the beyond."
As he spoke the words, Valen was struck by the conviction in his own voice, the depth of his own belief. He had seen so much of the world now, so many gods, yet the words came from his lips with absolute conviction.
"I heard my mother's voice."
Chapter 6. The days following the departure of the Red Falcon quickly took on a tense monotony. Every morning, Valen went to speak to Sister Gilma at the mansion gate. So far, the only new case had been the daughter's maid, a woman of middle years who wasn't expected to last the week. The girl herself, aided by her youth, was suffering the symptoms with great fortitude, but was unlikely to live out the month.
"And you, sister?"
he asked every morning.
"Are you well?"
She would smile her bright smile and give a small nod. He dreaded the day he climbed the path to the gate and found she wasn't there to greet him. Once word of the outbreak spread, the mood in the city became palpably fearful, although reactions varied. Some, mainly the richer citizens, collected their valuables and close relatives together before proceeding immediately to the nearest gate, demanding to be allowed to leave and resorting to threats or bribes when refused. When the bribes failed, some conspired to rush the gates at nightfall in company with armed bodyguards and servants. The wolf runners had easily repulsed the assault, clubbing them back with the staves Canis had had the foresight to issue when the crisis arose. Luckily, there had been no deaths, but the mood of the city's elite remained resentful and often desperately fearful. Some had barricaded themselves in their houses, refusing all visitors, and even loosing arrows or crossbow bolts at trespassers. The less well-off were equally fearful, but more stoic in facing their fear, and so far there had been no riots. For the most part, people went about their normal business, albeit spending as little time on the streets or in the company of neighbors as possible. All submitted to the regular inspections for signs of the sickness, with a resigned trepidation. As yet, there had been no cases in the city itself, though Sister Gilma seemed certain it was only a matter of time. "The Red Hand always started in the port towns," she said one morning, "carried by ships from across the sea. No doubt that's how it came here. Governor Arawan tells me the girl liked to go to the docks and watch the ships coming and going. If you find another case, it'll most likely be a sailor." Fearful as the townspeople were, he found himself more worried by his own soldiers. The Wolfrunner's discipline was holding well, but the others were more restive. There had been several ugly brawls between Count Marvin's Nilsalins and the Cumbrelian archers, producing some serious injuries on both sides and forcing him to flog the worst offenders. The only desertions had been from the Realm Guard. 5 of Lord Alcordlin's Blue Jays slipping over the wall with looted provisions in the hope of making it to Untesh. Valen had been tempted to let them perish in the desert, but knew an example had to be made, so sent Barkus after them with a scout troop. 2 days later he returned with the bodies. Valin having instructed him to administer sentence on the spot, to spare the spectacle of a public hanging. He had the corpses burned within sight of the main gate, to ensure the guards on the wall got the message, and spread it to their comrades. No one was going anywhere. In the afternoons he toured the walls and the gates, forcing conversation on the men despite their obvious discomfort. The Realm Guard were rigidly respectful but scared, the Nilsaelins sullen, and the Cumbrelians clearly detested the very sight of the Darkblade. But he spent time with all of them, asking questions about their families and their lives before the war. The answers were the standard, clipped responses soldiers always gave to the ritual pleasantries of their commanders, but he knew his distance from them was immaterial. They needed to see him, and know he was unafraid. One day he found Bren Antesh near the western gate, a hand shielding his eyes from the sun as he gazed up at a bird hovering overhead. "Vulture?" Valin asked. As was his custom, the Cumbrelian leader gave no formal greeting, something Valin found irked him not at all. "Hawk," he replied, "of a type I haven't seen before. Looks a little like the Swift Wing from home." Of all the captains, Antesh had reacted with the greatest calm to the crisis, placating his men and assuring them they were in no danger. His word clearly held considerable sway, as there had been no attempts at desertion by any of the archers. "I wanted to thank you," Valin said, "for the discipline of your men. They must trust you greatly." "They trust you too, brother. Almost as much as they hate you." Valin saw little reason to argue the point. He moved next to Antesh, resting against the battlement. "I have to say I was surprised the king was able to recruit so many men from your fief. When Senta's Mustor took the fief lord's chair, his first act was to abolish the law requiring daily practice with the longbow and the monthly stipend that came with it. Most of my men are farmers. The stipend helped supplement their income. Without it, many couldn't feed their families. They may hate King Janus with a passion, but hatred doesn't put food in the mouth of your children. Do they really believe I'm this dark blade from your 10 books? You slew Black Arrow, and the True Blade. Actually, Brother Barkus killed Henta's Muster. And to this day I still don't know if the man I killed in the Martish was really Black Arrow." The Cumbrelian captain shrugged. "In any case, the 4th book relates how no godly man can kill the Darkblade. I have to say, brother, you do seem to fit the description quite well. As for the use of the dark, well, who can say?" Antesh's face was cautious, as if expecting some sort of rebuke or threat. Valin decided a change of subject was appropriate. "And you, sir, did you enlist to feed your children?" "I have no children. No wife either. Just my bow and the clothes I'm wearing." "What of the king's gold? Surely you have that too." Antesh seemed agitated, looking away, his eyes searching the sky once again for the hawk. "I lost it. As I understand it, every man was paid 20 golds up front. That's a lot to lose." Antesh didn't turn back. "Do you require something of me, brother?" The Bloodsong gave a short murmur of unease, not the shrill warning of impending attack, but a suggestion of deception. He hides something. "I'd like to hear more of Darkblade," Valin said, "if you would care to tell me. That would mean learning more of the 10 books. Aren't you afraid your soul will be sullied by such knowledge? Your faith undone?" The Cumbrelian's words summoned Henta's Muster from his memory, seeing again the guilt and the madness in the usurper's eyes. The Bloodsong's murmur grew louder. Did he know him? Had he been one of his followers? "I doubt any knowledge could sully a man's soul. And as I told your True Blade, my faith cannot be undone. The 1st book tells us to teach the truth of the World Father's love to any who wish to hear it. Find me again and I'll tell you more, if you wish." In the evenings, he would make his way to Arm Lin's shop, where his wife would scowl murderously as she poured tea, and the stonemason would coach him in the ways of the song. "Amongst my people it's called the Music of Heaven," Arm Lin explained one night. They were in the workshop, sipping tea from small porcelain bowls next to the statue of the wolf, which appeared more unnervingly real every time Valin visited. The mason's wife wouldn't allow Valin into the house itself, where she invariably secluded herself after pouring the tea. He had once made the mistake of suggesting they pour it themselves, which had provoked such an outraged glare that he waited until Arm Lin took a sip from his own cup, for fear she had poisoned the beverage.
"Your people?" Beren asked.
He had deduced that the Mason hailed from the far west, but knew little of the place beyond the tales of sailors, fanciful stories of a vast land of endless fields and great cities, where the merchant kings held sway. "I was born in the province of Chin Sa, under the benevolent rule of the great merchant king Lol Than, a man who knew well the value of those with unusual gifts. When mine became known to the village elders, I was taken from my family at age 10 and brought to the king's court, to be tutored in the music of heaven. I remember I was terribly homesick, but never tried to run away. It was the law that the treason of the son extends to the father, and I didn't wish him to suffer for my disobedience, though I longed to return to his shop and work the stone again. He was a mason too, you see. There is no shame in the dark in your homeland?"
"Hardly. It is seen as a blessing, a gift from heaven. A family with a gifted child gains great honor."
His expression clouded.
"Or so it was said." "So you were taught the song. You know how to use it. You know where it comes from."
Arm Lin smiled, sadly. "The song cannot be taught, brother. And it doesn't come from anywhere. It is simply what you are. Your song is not another being living inside you. It is you."
"The song of my blood," he murmured, recalling the words of Nursa Silnin in the Martish.
"I have heard it called that, a name that suits well enough. So if it cannot be taught, what could they teach you?"
"Control, brother. It is like any other song. To sing it well, it must be practiced, honed, perfected. My tutor was an old woman called Xin La. So old she had to be carried around the palace on a litter, and couldn't see more than a foot or two beyond her nose. But her song..." He shook his head in wonder at the memory. "Her song was like fire, burning so bright and loud, you felt blinded and deafened by it all at once. The first time she sang to me, I nearly fainted. She cackled and called me rat. Little singing rat. Arm Lin, in the language of my people."
"She sounds a harsh teacher," Finan observed, reminded of Master Solis.
"Harsh? Yes, she was that. But she had much to teach me and little time left in which to do it. Our gift is extremely rare, brother, and in all her long life of service to the merchant king and his father before him, she had never met another singer. I was her replacement. Her lessons were harsh, painful. She needed no stick to strike me. Her song could hurt me well enough. It started with the truth-telling. Two men would be brought in, one having committed a crime of some sort. Each would claim innocence, and she would ask me which was guilty. Every time I got it wrong, and it happened often at first, her song would lash me with its fire.
'Truth is the heart of the song, rat,' she would say. 'If you cannot hear truth, you cannot hear anything.'
Once I had mastered the art of hearing truth, the lessons became more complex. A servant would be given a token, a precious jewel or ornament, and told to hide it somewhere within the palace. If I didn't find it by nightfall, the servant could keep it, and I would be punished for its loss. Later, a large group of people would mill around one of the courtyards, talking at the top of their voices, with one of them carrying a dagger beneath his robes. I had only 5 minutes to find it before her song would stab me as the dagger would have stabbed our master. For as she never failed to remind me, I owed all to him, and to fail him would be my eternal shame.
The merchant king made use of your song?"
"Indeed he did. Commerce is the lifeblood of the Far West. Those who trade well become great men, even kings of men. And successful commerce requires knowledge, especially knowledge others wish to keep hidden."
"You were a spy?"
Arm Lin shook his head.
"Merely a witness to the affairs of greater and richer men. At first, Lol Than would have me sit in the corner of his throne room, playing with his children. If anyone asked, I was said to be his ward, orphan son of a distant cousin. Naturally, most assumed I was his bastard, an unimportant but nonetheless honored position at court. As I played,
Men would come and go with varying degrees of ceremony, and protracted effusions of respect or regret at besmirching the king's palace with their unworthy presence. I noted that the richer the man's clothes or the larger his entourage, the more he would proclaim his abject unworthiness, at which Lol Than would assure them no insult had been suffered, and offer his apologies for not providing a more ostentatious welcome. It could take an hour or more before the true reason for the visit became apparent, and it was almost always about money. Some wanted to borrow it, others were owed it, and all wanted more of it. And as they talked, I would listen. When they were gone, with an assurance the king would give them a swift answer and an apology for the appalling discourtesy of delaying response to their request, he would ask me what song the music of heaven had sung during the conversation. Being but a boy, I had little notion of the true import of these affairs, but my song didn't need to know why a man lied or deceived, or hid hatred behind smiles and great respect. Lol Than knew why, of course, and in knowing, saw the road to either profit or loss, or occasionally the axeman's block. And so I lived my life at the Merchant King's Palace, learning from Xin La, telling the truth of my song to Lol Than. I had few friends, only those permitted me by the courtiers appointed my guardians. They were a dull lot, mostly, happy but unquestioning children from the minor merchant families who had bought a place at court for their offspring. In time I came to realize my playmates were chosen for their dullness, their lack of guile or cunning. Friends with sharper minds would have sharpened my own thoughts, made me consider that this pleasant life of luxury and plenty was in reality nothing more than an ornate cage, and I a slave within it. There were rewards, of course, as I grew to manhood and the lusts of youth took me, girls if I wanted, boys if I wanted, fine wine and all manner of bliss-giving potions if I asked, though never enough to dull the sound of my song. When I grew too old to play with Lol Than's children, I became one of his scribes. There were always at least three at every meeting, and no one seemed to notice that my calligraphy was clumsy and often barely legible. Life in my cage was simple, untroubled by the trials of the world beyond the tall walls that surrounded me. Then Xin La died. His gaze had become distant, lost in the memory, shrouded in sorrow. It is not an easy thing for a singer to hear another's death song. It was so loud I wondered the whole world couldn't hear it. A scream of such anger and regret. It sent me reeling into oblivion. Sometimes I think she was trying to take me with her. Not out of spite, but duty. In hearing her final song, I understood that her devotion to Lol Than was a lie. The greatest of lies, since she managed to keep it from her song throughout all the years she had taught me. Her final song was the scream of a slave who had never escaped her master, and didn't wish to leave me there alone. And she showed me something, a vision, born of the song, a village, ruined, smoking, littered with corpses. My village. He shook his head, his voice laden with such sadness that Valen realized he was the first person to hear this story. I was so blind, Armin continued after a moment. I failed to realize that the value in my gift lay in no one's knowing of its existence. No one save Lol Than and the old woman I would replace. I remembered all the people Xin La had used in her lessons, all the suspected criminals and servants. There must have been hundreds over the years. I knew they could never be allowed to live with the knowledge of my gift. I had killed them merely by being in their presence. When I woke from the oblivion Xin La had dragged me to, I found I had a new sensation burning in my soul. He turned to Valen, an odd glint in his eye, like a man recalling his own madness. Do you know hate, brother? Valen thought of his father's disappearing into the morning mist, Princess Lerna's tears, and his barely suppressed urge to break the king's neck. Our catechism of faith tells us hate is a burden on the soul. I have found much truth in that. It weighs on a man's soul, true enough, but it can also set you free. Armed with my hate, I began to take note of the meetings Lol Than had me attend, to write down what was said with meticulous care. I began to conceive of just how vast his dominions were,
to learn of the 1,000 ships he owned, and the 1,000 more in which he had an interest. I learned of the mines where gold, jewels, and ore were hewn from the earth, of the vast fields in which lay his true wealth, the countless acres of wheat and rice that underwrote every transaction he made. And as I learned, I searched, poring over my papers for some flaw in the great web of trade. 4 more years passed, and I learned and searched, barely distracted by the comforts of the court, left to my efforts by the guardians I now knew to be my jailers, who saw no threat in my newfound studiousness. And all the time, the truth of my song never wavered, and I faithfully related to Lothan all it told me, every deceit and every secret, and his trust grew with every plot or fraud uncovered, so that I became more than his truth-teller. In time, I was as trustworthy a secretary as a man such as he could have. Give more knowledge, more strands to the web, all the time searching, waiting, but finding nothing. The merchant king knew his business too well. His web was perfect. Any lie I told him would be swiftly uncovered, and my death would follow swiftly after. There were times when I considered simply taking a dagger and sinking it into his heart. I had ample opportunity, after all. But I was still young, and though my hatred consumed me, I still lusted for life. I was a coward, a prisoner whose captivity was made worse by his knowledge of the vastness of his prison. Despair began to rot my heart. I fell to indulgence again, seeking escape in wine and drugs and flesh, an indulgence that would have seen me dead before long, had not the foreigners arrived. In all my years in Lothan's palace, I had never seen a foreigner. I had heard stories, of course, tales of strange white or black-skinned people who came from the east and were so uncivilized their very presence in the merchant king's domain was insulting and only tolerated because of the value of the cargoes they carried. The party that came to treat with Lothan were certainly strange to me, with their odd clothes and impenetrable language, to say nothing of their clumsy attempts at etiquette. And to my amazement, one of them was a woman with a song. The only women allowed in the presence of the merchant king were his wives, daughters, or concubines. In my homeland, they have no role in business, and are forbidden from owning property. Through the interpreter, I was given to understand that this woman was of high birth, and to refuse her admittance would be a grave insult to her people. The likely profits from whatever proposal these foreigners intended must have been great indeed for Lothan to allow her entry to the audience chamber. The interpreter continued, but I could barely follow his words. The woman's song filled my mind, and I couldn't help staring at her. This was a beautiful woman, brother, but beautiful in a way a leopard is beautiful. Her eyes glittered. Her black hair shone like polished ebony, and her smile was one of cruel amusement as she heard my song. "So the slant-eyed pig has a singer of his own," her song said, the hollow laughter that colored it making me tremble. She was powerful. I could sense it. Her song was stronger than mine. Shin La may have been able to match her, but not I. The rat had met a cat, and was helpless before it. "What can you tell me, I wonder?" she sang in my mind, the song plunging deeper, reaching into memory and feeling with brutal ease, dragging up all my hate and my scheming. My intended betrayal seemed to make her exultant, fiercely triumphant. "And the council told me this would be difficult," she sang. Her gaze lingered on mine for a moment longer. "If you want the merchant king dead, tell him to reject our offer." Then it was gone. Her intrusion into my mind withdrawn, leaving behind a chill of certainty. She was here to kill Lothan if he refused whatever they proposed. And she wanted to kill him. The outcome of the negotiations meant nothing to her. She had traveled across half the world for blood, and would not be denied it. Amnin's face was tense with remembered pain. "Sometimes the song lets us touch the minds of others. In all the years since, I must have touched thousands. But never have I felt anything to compare with the black stain of that woman's thoughts. For years afterwards I had nightmares, visions of slaughter, murder practiced with sadistic precision, faces screaming, or frozen in fear, men, women, children, and visions of places I had never seen, languages I couldn't understand. I thought I was going mad until I realized she had left some of her memories with me, either out of indifference or casual malice. They faded over time, mostly. But even now there are nights when I wake screaming and my wife holds me as I weep. "Who was she?" Benin asked. "Where did she come from?" The name spoken by the interpreter was a lie. I sensed that even before I heard her song. And the memories she left gave no clue as to name or family. As for where she was from, it meant nothing to me at the time, but the delegation presented greetings from the High Council of the Valerian Empire. What I've learned of the Valerians since leads me to conclude she would have been most at home there. "Did you do it? Did you tell the Merchant King to reject their proposal?" Armlin nodded, without a moment's hesitation. Shocked as I was, my hatred was undimmed. I told them they were full of lies, that their scheme was an attempt to spend his treasure and save their own. In truth, I had barely any understanding of what they had proposed, or if their word was true. As always, however, he trusted my verdict implicitly. And did she keep her word? At first I thought she had betrayed me. Lolfan gave them his answer the next morning, after which they boarded their ship and sailed away. He appeared to be in fine health and gave every impression of remaining so. Disappointment and fear crushed me. For the first time, I had lied to the Merchant King. Surely I would be discovered, and an ugly death would follow. A month passed as I worried and fought to conceal my fear, and then Lolthan slowly began to sicken. It was nothing at first, a small but persistent cough that, of course, no one would dare to mention. Then his color became paler. His hands began to tremble. Within weeks he was coughing blood and raving in fits. By the time he died, he was a wasted bundle of bone and skin that couldn't remember its own name. I felt no pity at all. He had a successor, of course, his third son, Ma'lol, the two older brothers having been quietly poisoned in early manhood, when it became clear they lacked their father's acumen. Ma'lol was truly his father's son, highly intelligent, exceptionally well-educated, and possessed of all the cunning and ruthlessness needed to sit on a merchant king's throne. But to my great delight, he knew nothing of my gift. Lolthan's illness had left him in no state to enlighten his son as to the nature of my role at court. To Ma'lol, I was simply an unusually trusted secretary, and he had his own man for that. I was consigned to a bookkeeping position in the palace stores, moved from my fine quarters and paid a fraction of the salary I'd received before. Apparently, I was expected to kill myself in shame at my fall from royal favor, as many of Lolthan's now redundant servants had already done. Instead, I simply left, telling the guard at the palace gate that I had an errand to run in the city. He barely glanced at me as I walked out. I was 22 years old, and a free man for the first time. It was the sweetest moment of my life. Freedom brought a change in my song, made it soar, seeking out wonders and novelty. I followed its music across the breadth of Ma'lol's kingdom and beyond. It guided me to a stonemason in a small village high in the mountains, who, lacking sons or apprentices, agreed to teach me his craft. I think he was disturbed by the speed with which I learned, not to say the unusual quality of my work, and he seemed relieved when it became clear he had no more to teach me and I moved on. The song guided me to a port where I took ship to the east. For the next 20 years I travelled and worked, from city to city, town to town, leaving my mark on houses, palaces, and temples. I even spent a year in your realm, carving gargoyles for a Nilsalian lord's castle. I never wanted for anything. In lean times, the song guided me to food and work. When times were fraught, it sought out peace and solitude. I never questioned it, never resisted it. 5 years ago it guided me here, where Shuala, my most excellent wife, was struggling to keep her late father's shop going. She had the skills, but richer Alperians don't like to deal with women. I have been here ever since. My song has never signaled a need to move on, for which I am grateful. Even now,
Fenin wondered. With the Red Hand in the city? Did your song raise its voice when you first heard the sickness was here? Fenin remembered the despair he felt at Sister Gilmer's likely fate, but realized it hadn't been colored by the blood song.
No. No, it didn't. Does this mean there's no danger?
Hardly. It means that, for whatever reason, this is where we are both supposed to be. This is...
Fenin fumbled for the right words.
Our destiny?
Armlin shrugged.
Who can say, brother?
Of destiny I know little but to say I've seen so much of the random and unexpected in my life as to doubt there is such a thing.
We make our own path, but with the song's guidance.
Your song is you, remember.
You can sing it as well as hear it.
How?
Fenin leaned forward, discomfited by the hunger for knowledge he knew colored his voice.
How do I sing?
Armlin gestured at the workbench, where Valin's partly carved block still sat, untouched, since his first visit.
You've already started.
I suspect you've been singing a long time, brother. The song can make us reach for many different tools. The pen, the chisel, or the sword.
Valin glanced down at his sword, resting within easy reach against the edge of the table.
Is that what I've been doing all these years? Cutting my path through life? All the blood spilled and lives taken? Just verses in a song?
Why haven't you finished it? Armlin inquired.
The sculpture.
If I pick up the hammer and chisel again, I won't put them down until it's done. And our current circumstance requires my full attention.
He knew this to be only partly true. The roughly hewn features emerging from the block had begun to take on a disturbing familiarity. Not yet recognizable, but enough to make him conclude that the finished version would be a face he knew. Perversely, the arrival of the Red Hand had been a welcome excuse for delaying the moment of final clarity.
It's not advisable to ignore one's song, brother, Armlin cautioned him.
You recalled the harm I did when I called to you the first time.
Why do you think that was?
My song was silent.
That's right.
And why was it silent?
The king's fragile neck.
The whore's dangerous secrets.
It called on me to do something, something terrible. When I couldn't do it, my song fell silent. I thought it had deserted me.
Your song is your protection as well as your guide. Without it, you are vulnerable to others, who can do as we do.
Like the Valerian woman. Trust me, brother. You wouldn't wish to be vulnerable to her.
Fenin looked at the marble block, tracing the rough profile of the unformed face.
"When the Red Falcon returns," he said, "I'll finish it then."
20 days after the Red Falcon's departure, the sailors rioted, breaking out of their makeshift prisons in the warehouse district, killing their guards, and making for the docks in a well-planned assault. Canis was quick to respond, ordering 2 companies of wolf runners to hold the docks and drafting in Count Marvin's men to seal off the surrounding streets. Cumberlin archers were placed on the rooftops, cutting down dozens of sailors as their attack on the docks faltered, in the face of disciplined resistance, and they went reeling back into the city. Canis ordered an immediate counterattack, and the brief but bloody revolt was all but over by the time Valin got to the scene. He found Canis fighting a large Meldinian. The big man swinging a crudely fashioned club at the lithe brother, as he danced around him, sword flicking out to leave cuts on his arms and face.
"Give up," he ordered, his blade slicing into the man's forearm. "It's over."
The Meldinian gave a roar of pain-fueled rage and redoubled his efforts, his useless club meeting only air as Canis continued his vicious dance. Valin unlimbered his bow, notched an arrow and sent it cleanly through the Meldinian's neck from 40 paces. One of his better feats of archery.
"Not a time for half measures, brother," he told Canis,
stepping over the Meldinian's corpse and drawing his sword. Within the hour, it was done. Nearly 200 sailors were dead, and at least as many wounded. The wolf runners had lost 15 men, among them the one-time pickpocket known as Dipper, one of the original 30 chosen men from their days in the Martish. They herded the sailors back into their warehouses, and Valin had the surviving captains brought to the docks. 40 men or so, all with the blunt and weathered features common to sea captains. They were lined up on the quayside, kneeling before him, arms bound, most staring up with sullen fear or open defiance. "Your actions were stupid and selfish," Velin told them. "If you had reached your ships, you would have carried plague to 100 other ports. I have lost good men in this pathetic farce. I could execute you all, but I won't." He gestured at the harbour, where the many ships of the city's merchant fleet were at anchor. "They say a captain's soul rests with his ship. You killed 15 of my men. I require 15 souls in recompense." It took a long time, with boatloads of Realm Guard hauling at the oars as they towed the vessels out of the harbour and anchored them offshore, spreading pitch on the decks and dousing the sails and rigging with lamp oil. Dentos's archers finished the job with volleys of fire arrows, and by nightfall, 15 ships were burning, tall flames fountaining embers into the starlit sky and lighting up the sea for miles around. Velin surveyed the captains, taking dull satisfaction from the grief in their weathered faces, some with tears gleaming in their eyes. "Any repeat of this foolishness," he said, "and I'll have you and your crews lashed to the masts before I burn the rest of the fleet." In the morning, Velin found Governor Arawan at the mansion gate. There was no sign of Sister Gilmer, and an icy claw of fear gripped his insides. "Where's my sister?" he asked. The governor's once fleshy face was sagging from worry and a too sudden weight loss, although he showed no sign of the Red Hand. His gaze was guarded and his voice flat. "She succumbed yesterday evening, much more quickly than my daughter or her maid. I recall my mother saying that was how it was with the sickness years ago. Some last for days, weeks even. Others fade in a matter of hours. Your sister wouldn't let me near my daughter, insisted on caring for her alone. My servants and I were forbidden from even venturing into that wing of the mansion. She said it was necessary to stop the spread of the sickness. Last night I found her collapsed on the stairs, barely conscious. She forbade me from touching her, crawled back to my daughter's room on her own." He trailed off as Valen's expression darkened. "I spoke to her yesterday," he said stupidly. He searched the governor's face for some sign he was mistaken, finding only wary regret. His voice was thick as he voiced the redundant question. "She's dead?" The governor nodded. "The maid, too. My daughter lingers, though. We burnt the bodies, as your sister instructed." Velin found himself gripping the wrought iron of the gate with white-knuckled fists. Gilmer. Bright-eyed, laughing Gilmer. Dead and lost to the fire in a matter of hours whilst I tarried with those idiot sailors. "Were there any words?" he asked. "Did she leave any testament?" "She faded very fast, my lord. She said to tell you to keep her instructions, and you will see her again in the beyond." Velin looked closely at the governor's face. "He's lying. She said nothing. She just sickened and died." Nevertheless, he found himself grateful for the deceit. "Thank you, my lord. Do you require anything? Some more salve for my daughter's rash? Perhaps a few bottles of wine? It keeps the servants happy and our stocks are running low." "I'll see to it." He unclasped his hands from the gate and turned to go. "There was a great fire in the night," the governor said. "Out to sea. The sailors rioted, tried to escape. I burned some ships as punishment." He was expecting some kind of admonishment, but the governor simply nodded. "A measured response. However, I advise you to compensate the Merchants Guild. With me confined here, they are the only civil authority in the city. Best not to antagonize them." Velin was more inclined to flog any merchant who made the mistake of raising his voice within earshot, but through the fog of his grief, saw the wisdom in the governor's words. "I will." For some reason he paused, feeling compelled to add something, some reward for the governor's kindly lies. "We will not be here long, my lord. Maybe a few more months. There will be blood and fire when the Emperor's army arrives,
but win or lose, we will soon be gone, and this city will be yours again." The governor's expression was a mixture of bafflement and anger. "Then why, in the name of all the gods, did you come here?" Velin gazed out at the city. The light of the morning sun played over the houses and empty streets below. Out to sea, the ocean shimmered with gold. White-topped waves swept towards the coast, and the sky above was a cloudless blue. And Sister Gilma was dead, along with thousands of others and thousands more to come. "There is something I have to do," he said, walking away. He found Dentos atop the lighthouse, at the far end of the mole forming the left shoulder of the harbor entrance. He sat with his legs dangling over the lip of the lighthouse's flat top, staring out to sea and sipping from a flask of Brother's Friend. His bow lay nearby, the quiver empty. Velin sat down next to him, and Dentos passed him the flask. "You didn't come to hear the words for our sister," he said, taking a small sip and handing the flask back, grimacing slightly as the mingled brandy and red flower burned its way down his throat.
"Said my own words," Dentos muttered. "She heard me."
Velin glanced down at the base of the lighthouse, where numerous lifeless seagulls bobbed in the water, all neatly skewered with a single arrow. "Looks like the gulls heard you too."
"Practicing," Dentos said. "Filthy scavengers anyhow. Can't stand them. Bloody noise they make. Shytorks, my Uncle Grol called them. He was a sailor."
He grunted a laugh and took another drink.
"Could be I killed him last night. Can't rightly remember what the bastard looked like."
"How many uncles do you have, brother?"
"I've always wondered."
Dentos's face clouded, and he said nothing for a long time. When he finally spoke, there was a somber tone to his voice Velin hadn't heard before.
"None."
Velin frowned in puzzlement.
"What about the one with the fighting dogs? And the one who taught you the bow?"
"I taught myself the bow. There was a master hunter in our village, but he wasn't my uncle. Neither was that vicious shitbag with the dogs."
"None of them were."
He glanced at Velin and smiled sadly.
"My dear old mum was the village whore, brother. She called the many men who came to our door my uncles. Made them be nice to me or they weren't getting in her bed. Any one of them could have been my dad after all."
"Never did find out which one. Not that I gave a dog's fart. They were a pretty worthless bunch. Whore or not, my mum always did her best for me. I was never hungry, and I always had clothes on my back and shoes on my feet, unlike most of the other children in the village. Bad enough being the whore's whelp, worse being an envied whore's whelp. It was common knowledge my dad could have been one of 30-odd men in the village, so the other kids called me Who's Bastard. I was about 4 when I first heard it. Who's Bastard? Who's Bastard? Where'd you get your shoes from, Who's Bastard?" On and on it went, year after year. There was this one lad, Uncle Bab's boy. Mean little shit he was. Always the first to start shouting. One day him and his gang started throwing stuff at me. Sharp stuff, some of it. I got all cut up. It made me angry. So I took my bow, put an arrow through that boy's leg. Can't say I was sorry to watch him bleed and cry and flail around. After that," he shrugged, "couldn't really stay there anymore. No one was going to apprentice the whore's bastard, a dangerous bastard at that. So my mum packed me off to the order. I can still remember her crying when the cart took me away. I've never been back." Watching him swig from his flask, Velin was struck by how old Dentos looked. Deep lines marked his brows, and premature grey coloured in the close-cropped hair at his temples. Years of battle and hard living had aged him, and his grief for Sister Gilma was palpable. Of all the brothers, she had been closest to him. "When we return to the realm, I'll ask the Aspect to give him a position at the Order House," Velin decided, then realized that there was every chance neither of them would see the realm again. All he had to offer Dentos were yet more opportunities for a bloody end. His thoughts turned again to the marble block waiting in Armlin's shop, and he knew he had delayed too long. It was time he did what he had been sent here to do. If he could achieve it before the Alperin army arrived, then perhaps another slaughter could be avoided. If he was willing to pay the price.
He got to his feet, touching Dentos on the shoulder in farewell. I have business. Dentos's weary eyes were suddenly bright with excitement, and his finger shot out to point at the horizon.
A sail! You see it, brother?
Valen shielded his eyes to scan the sea. It was the merest speck, a smudge of grey between water and sky, but unmistakably a sail. The Red Falcon was back. Captain Nurin was first down the gangplank, his lean, weathered face drawn with exhaustion, but the light of triumph burned in his eyes, along with the greed Valen remembered so well from their first meeting.
21 days, he exulted. Wouldn't have thought it possible so late in the year, but Udenor heard our calls and made a gift of the winds. Would have been 18 if we hadn't had to tarry so long in Varenshold, nor carry so many passengers back.
So many passengers? Valen asked. His gaze was fixed on the gangplank, expecting a slender, dark-haired form to appear at any second.
9 in all.
Though why a girl whose head barely reaches my shoulder needs 7 men to guard her is beyond me, I must say.
Valen turned to him, frowning.
Guards?
Nurin shrugged, gesturing at the gangplank.
See for yourself.
The heavy-set man descending the gangplank had a squat, brutish face, unleavened by the scowl with which he regarded Valen and the surrounding wolf-runners. More disconcerting still was the fact that he wore the black robe of the Fourth Order and a sword at his belt.
"Brother Valen," he inquired in a flat tone devoid of civility.
Valen nodded, growing uneasy, dispelling any urge to offer a greeting.
"Brother Commander Iltis," the black-robed man introduced himself. "Faith Protection Company of the Fourth Order."
"Never heard of you," Valen told him. "Where are Sister Sharon and Brother Frentis?"
Brother Iltis blinked, clearly unused to disrespect.
"The prisoner and Brother Frentis are aboard ship. We have some issues to discuss, brother. Certain arrangements must be made."
Valen had heard only one word.
"Prisoner."
His voice was soft, but he was aware of the menace it possessed. Brother Iltis blinked again, his scowl fading to an uncertain frown.
"What prisoner?"
The sound of creaking wood made him turn back to the ship. Another brother of the Fourth Order, also armed with a sword, was leading a dark-haired young woman by a chain attached to shackles on her wrists. Sharon was paler than he remembered, also somewhat thinner, but the bright, open smile that lit her face as their eyes met remained unchanged. Another 5 brothers followed her onto the quay, spreading out on either side, and eyeing Valen and the wolf runners with cold distrust. Last to descend was Frentis, his face drawn in shame, and his eyes averted.
"Sister."
Valen moved towards Sharon, but found his path suddenly blocked by Iltis.
"The prisoner is forbidden discourse with the faithful, brother."
"Get out of my way!" Valen ordered him, precisely and deliberately enunciating each word.
Iltis paled visibly but held his ground.
"I have my orders, brother."
"What is this?" Valen demanded, rage building in his chest.
"Why is our sister shackled so?"
Behind Iltis, Sharon lifted her shackled wrists, grimacing ruefully.
"I'm sorry you find me in chains once again." "The prisoner will not speak unless permitted," Iltis barked, rounding on her, tugging sharply on her chain, the shackles chafing her flesh, producing a wince of pain. "The prisoner will not sully the ears of the faithful with her heresy or treachery."
Sharon's eyes flicked to Valen, imploring. "Please don't kill him."
Chapter 7.
She was angry, he could tell, her expression rigid, eyes avoiding his gaze as they walked the track to the governor's mansion, her heavy chest of curatives weighing on his shoulder.
"I didn't kill him," Valen offered when the silence became unbearable.
"Because Brother Frentis stopped you?"
she replied, eyes flashing at him.
She was right, of course. If Frentis hadn't stopped him, he would have continued to beat Brother Iltis to death on the quayside. The other brothers from the Fourth Order had unwisely begun reaching for their weapons when Valen's first blow sent the man sprawling to the ground, quickly finding themselves disarmed by the surrounding wolf-runners.
They could only stand and watch helplessly, as Velen continued to smash his fist into Iltis's increasingly bloody and distorted face. Deaf to Sharon's pleading, and leaving off only when Frentis hauled him away.
"What is this?" he snarled, wrenching himself free. "How could you allow this?"
Frentis looked more shamed and miserable than Velen could remember.
"The Aspect's orders, brother," he replied in a soft murmur.
"Excuse me." Sharon jangled her chains, glaring at Velen. "Do you think I might be freed to tend to our brother before he bleeds to death?" And so she had tended to Brother Commander Iltis, ordering her chest to be carried from the ship and applying balms and salves to his cuts, before stitching the gash Velen had left in his brow when he pounded his forehead against the cobbles. She worked in silence, her deft hands doing their work with the clean efficiency he remembered. But there was a sharpness to her movements that bespoke a restrained anger. She didn't like seeing it, Velen realized. Didn't like seeing the killer in me.
"Get this lot to the jail," he told Frentis, waving a hand at the Fourth Order brothers. "If they give you any trouble, flog them."
Frentis nodded, hesitating.
"Brother, about the sister."
"We'll talk later, brother."
Frentis nodded again and moved away to take command of the prisoners. Nearby, Captain Nurin cleared his throat.
"What?"
Velen demanded.
"Your word, my lord,"
the wiry captain said. He was unnerved by the display of violence, but refused to be daunted, forcing himself to meet Velen's glare.
"Our arrangement, as noted before witnesses."
"Oh."
Velen tugged the bag containing the bluestone from his belt and tossed it to Nurin.
"Spend it wisely, sergeant."
The Wolfrunner sergeant quickly snapped to attention.
"My lord."
"Captain Nurin and his crew are to be detained with the other sailors. Search the ship thoroughly to ensure none are hiding aboard."
The sergeant saluted smartly and moved off, shouting orders.
"Detained, my lord?"
Nurin raised his eyes reluctantly from the bluestone, now grasped tightly in his fist.
"But I have urgent business."
"I'm sure you do, captain. However, the presence of the Red Hand in the city requires you remain with us a little longer."
The greed in the captain's eyes transformed abruptly into naked fear, and he took a few rapid backward steps.
"The Red Hand? Here?"
Velen turned back to Sister Sharon, watching her tie off the suture and snip away the stray threads with a small pair of scissors.
"Yes," he murmured, "but I suspect not for much longer. I told you once," Sharon said as they paused on the track to the governor's mansion.
"No one is going to die on my account. And I meant it, Velen."
"I'm sorry,"
he said, surprised at his sincerity. He had hurt her, made her feel every blow he landed on Iltis, made her see the killer. She sighed, some of the anger leeching from her face. "Tell me about the Red Hand. How many have died?"
"So far, only Sister Gilmer and a maid at the governor's mansion. His daughter still lingers, although she may have expired by now."
"No other cases? No sign of it anywhere else in the city?" He shook his head. "We followed Sister Gilmer's instructions to the letter. Then she may have saved the city by acting so quickly." They came to the mansion gate, where one of the guards rang the bell to call the governor. Velen eyed the mansion's dim windows as they waited. Since Sister Gilmer's passing, the place had taken on a sinister aspect, made worse by the shabby appearance of the untended gardens. He was half expecting no one to answer the bell, for the Red Hand to have finally run rampant through the house, leaving it an empty husk awaiting the torch. He was ashamed to find himself almost hoping it was over. With no outbreaks elsewhere in the city, it could end here, and there would be no need to send Sharon into danger.
"Is that the governor?" she asked.